who suffered a scratched cheek from the dog's scrabbling claws. She couldn't put it down, or he'd see it didn't limp. "She's in pain. Her leg's all crooked, and she's trying to lick it. It just makes me sick," Catherine lied. "I've got to get her to a vet." Mr. Gum's groan of rage and anguish made the little dog cry. "You think she's in pain," Mr. Gum said. "You don't know what pain is. You hurt her and I'll scald you." When she heard him pounding up the stairs, Catherine Martin sat down, shaken by gross jerks in her arms and legs. She couldn't hold the dog. She couldn't hold her water. She couldn't hold anything. When the little dog climbed into her lap, she hugged it, grateful for the warmth. Chapter 50. Feathers rode on the thick brown water, curled feathers blown from the coops, carried on breaths of air that shivered the skin of the river. The houses on Fell Street, Frederica Bimmel Street, were termed waterfront on the weathered realtors' signs, because their backyards ended at a slough, a backwater of the Licking River in Belvedere, Ohio, a Rust Belt town of 112,000 east of Columbus. It was a shabby neighborhood of big, old houses. A few of them had been bought cheap by young couples and renovated with Sears' best enamel, making the rest of the houses look worse. The Bimmel house had not been renovated. Clarice Starling stood for a moment in Frederica's backyard, looking at the feathers on the water, her hands deep in the pockets of her trench coat. There was some rotten snow in the reeds, blue beneath the blue sky on this mild winter day. Behind her, Starling could hear Frederica's father hammering in the city of pigeon coops, the Orvieto of pigeon coops rising from the water's edge and reaching almost to the house. She hadn't seen Mr. Bimmel yet. The neighbors said he was there. Their faces were closed when they said it. Starling was having some trouble with herself. At that moment, in the night when she knew she had to leave the academy to hunt Buffalo Bill, a lot of extraneous noises had stopped. She felt a pure, new silence in the center of her mind, and a calm there. In a different place, down the front of her, she felt in flashes that she was a truant and a fool. The petty annoyances of the morning hadn't touched her. Not the gymnasium stink of the airplane to Columbus, not the confusion and ineptitude at the rental car counter. She'd snapped at the car clerk to make him move, but she hadn't felt anything. Starling had paid a high price for this time, and she meant to use it as she thought best. Her time could be up at any moment, if Crawford was overruled and they pulled her credentials. She should hurry. But to think about why, to dwell on Catherine's plight on this final day, would be to waste the day entirely. To think of her in real time, being processed at this moment as Kimberly Emberg and Frederica Bimmel had been processed, would jam all other thought. The breeze fell off, the water still as death. Near her feet, a curled feather spun on the surface tension. "Hang on, Catherine." Starling caught her lip between her teeth. If he shot her, she hoped he'd do a competent job of it. "Teach us to care and not to care. Teach us to be still." She turned to the leaning stack of coops and followed a path of boards laid on the mud between them toward the sound of hammering. The hundreds of pigeons were of all sizes and colors. There were tall, knock-kneed ones and pouters with their chests stuck out. Eyes bright, heads jerking as they paced, the birds spread their wings in the pale sun and made pleasant sounds as she passed. Frederica's father, Gustav Bimmel, was a tall man, flat and wide-hipped, with red-rimmed eyes of watery blue. A knit cap was pulled down to his eyebrows. He was building another coop on sawhorses in front of his workshed. Starling smelled vodka on his breath as he squinted at her identification. "I don't know nothing new to tell you," he said. "The policemen come back here night before last. They went back over my statement with me again. Read it back to me. Is that right? Is that right? I told him, I said, 'Hell yes. If that wasn't right, I wouldn't have told you in the first place. I am trying to get an idea where the... kidnapper might have seen Frederica, Mr. Bimmel. Where he might have spotted her and decided to take her away. She went into Columbus on the bus to see about a job at that store there. The police said she got to the interview all right. She never came home. We don't know where else she went that day. The FBI got her master charge slips, but there wasn't nothing for that day. You know all that, don't you? About the credit card, yes, sir, I do. Mr. Bimmel, do you have Frederica's things? Are they here? Her room's in the top of the house. May I see? It took him a moment to decide where to lay down his hammer. All right, he said. Come along. Chapter 51. Jack Crawford's office in the FBI's Washington headquarters was painted an oppressive gray, but it had big windows. Crawford stood at these windows with his clipboard held to the light, peering at a list off a goddamn fuzzy dot matrix printer that he told him to get rid of. He'd come here from the funeral home and worked all morning, tweaking the Norwegians to hurry with their dental records on the missing seaman named Klaus, jerking San Diego's chain to check Benjamin Raspail's familiars at the conservatory where he had taught, and stirring up customs, which was supposed to be checking for import violations involving living insects. Within 5 minutes of Crawford's arrival, FBI Assistant Director John Golby, head of the new inter-service task force, stuck his head in the office for a moment to say, "Jack, we're all thinking about you. Everybody appreciates your coming in. Has the service been set yet?" "The wake's tomorrow evening. Service is Saturday at 11 o'clock. Golby nodded. "There's a UNICEF memorial, Jack, a fund. You want it to read Phyllis or Bella? We'll do it any way you like." "Bella, John. Let's make it Bella." "Can I do anything for you, Jack?" Crawford shook his head. "I'm just working. I'm just going to work now." "Right," Golby said. He waited the decent interval. "Frederick Chilton asked for federal protective custody." "Grand. John, is somebody in Baltimore talking to Everett Yao, Raspail's lawyer? I mentioned him to you. He might know something about Raspail's friends." "Yeah, they're on it this morning. I just sent Burroughs my memo on it. The director's putting Lecter on the most wanted. Jack, if you need anything..." Golby raised his eyebrows and his hand and backed out of sight. "If you need anything." Crawford turned to the windows. He had a fine view from his office. There was the handsome old post office building where he'd done some of his training. To the left was the old FBI headquarters. At graduation, he'd filed through J. Edgar Hoover's office with the others. Hoover stood on a little box and shook their hands in turn. That was the only time Crawford ever met the man. The next day, he married Bella. They had met in Livorno, Italy. He was Army, she NATO staff, and she was Phyllis then. They walked on the quays, and a boatman called Bella across the glittering water, and she was always Bella to him after that. She was only Phyllis when they disagreed. Bella's dead. That should change the view from these windows. It wasn't right this view stayed the same. Had to fucking die on me. Jesus, kid, I knew it was coming, but it smarts. What do they say about forced retirement at 55? You fall in love with the Bureau, but it doesn't fall in love with you. He'd seen it. Thank God Bella had saved him from that. He hoped she was somewhere today, and that she was comfortable at last. He hoped she could see in his heart. The phone was buzzing its intra-office buzz. "Mr. Crawford, Dr. Danielson from..." "Right, Punch. Jack Crawford, doctor." "Is this line secure, Mr. Crawford?" "Yes, on this end it is." "You're not taping, are you?" "No, Dr. Danielson. Tell me what's on your mind." "I want to make it clear this has nothing to do with anybody who was ever a patient at Johns Hopkins." "Understood." "If anything comes of it, I want you to make it clear to the public he's not a transsexual. He had nothing to do with this institution. Fine. You got it, absolutely. Come on, you stuffy bastard. Crawford would have said anything. He shoved Dr. Purvis down. Who, Dr. Danielson? He applied to the program 3 years ago as John Grant of Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. Description? Caucasian male. He was 31, 6 feet 1, 190 pounds. He came to be tested and did very well on the Wechsler intelligence scale, bright, normal. But the psychological testing and the interviews were another story. In fact, his house tree person and his TAT were spot on with the sheet you gave me. You let me think Alan Bloom authored that little theory, but it was Hannibal Lecter, wasn't it? Go on with Grant, Doctor. The board would have turned him down anyway, but by the time we met to discuss it, the question was moot, because the background checks got him. Got him how? We routinely check with the police in an applicant's hometown. The Harrisburg police were after him for 2 assaults on homosexual men. The last one nearly died. He'd given us an address that turned out to be a boarding house he stayed in from time to time. The police got his fingerprints there and a credit card gas receipt with his license number on it. His name wasn't John Grant at all, he'd just told us that. About a week later, he waited outside the building here and shoved Dr. Purvis down just for spite. What was his name, Dr. Danielson? I'd better spell it for you. It's J-A-M-E-G-U-M-B. Chapter 52. Frederica Bimmel's house was 3 stories tall and gaunt, covered with asphalt shingles stained rusty where the gutters had spilled over. Volunteer maples growing in the gutters had stood up to the winter pretty well. The windows on the north side were covered with sheet plastic. In a small parlor, very warm from a space heater, a middle-aged woman sat on a rug playing with an infant. "My wife," Bimmel said as they passed through the room. "We just got married Christmas." "Hello," Starling said. The woman smiled vaguely in her direction. Cold in the hall again, and everywhere boxes stacked waist-high, filling the rooms, passageways among them, cardboard cartons filled with lampshades and canning lids, picnic hampers, back numbers of the Reader's Digest and National Geographic, thick old tennis rackets, bed linens, a case of dartboards, fiber car seat covers in a 50s plaid with the intense smell of mouse pee. "We're moving pretty soon," Mr. Bimmel said. The stuff near the windows was bleached by the sun, the boxes stacked for years and bellied with age, the random rugs worn bare in the paths through the rooms. Sunlight dappled the banister as Starling climbed the stairs behind Frederica's father. His clothes smelled stale in the cold air. She could see sunlight coming through the sagging ceiling at the top of the stairwell. The cartons stacked on the landing were covered with plastic. Frederica's room was small, under the eaves on the 3rd floor. "You want me any more?" "Later I'd like to talk to you, Mr. Bimmel. What about Frederica's mother? The file said deceased. It didn't say when." "What do you mean, what about her? She died when Frederica was 12. "I see. Did you think that was Frederica's mother downstairs, after I told you we'd just been married since Christmas? That's what you thought, isn't it? I guess the law is used to handling a different class of people, Missy. She never knew Frederica at all." "Mr. Bimmel, is the room pretty much like Frederica left it?" The anger wandered somewhere else in him. "Yeah," he said softly. "We just left it alone. Nobody much could wear her stuff. Plug in the heater if you want it. Remember and unplug it before you come down." He didn't want to see the room. He left her on the landing. Starling stood for a moment with her hand on the cold porcelain knob. She needed to organize a little before her head was full of Frederica's things. "Okay. The premise is Buffalo Bill did Frederica first, waded her and hid her well in a river far from home. He hid her better than the others. She was the only one waited, because he wanted the later ones found first. He wanted the idea of random selection of victims in widely scattered towns well established before Frederica of Belvedere was found. It was important to take attention away from Belvedere. Because he lives here. Or maybe in Columbus. He started with Frederica because he coveted her hide. We don't begin to covet with imagined things. Coveting is a very literal sin. We begin to covet with tangibles. We begin with what we see every day. He saw Frederica in the course of his daily life. He saw her in the course of her daily life. What was the course of Frederica's daily life? All right. Starling pushed the door open. Here it was, this still room smelling of mildew in the cold. On the wall, last year's calendar was forever turned to April. Frederica had been dead 10 months. Cat food, hard and black, was in a saucer in the corner. Starling, veteran yard sale decorator, stood in the center of the room and turned slowly around. Frederica had done a pretty good job with what she had. There were curtains of flowered chintz. Judging from the piped edges, she had recycled some slip covers to make the curtains. There was a bulletin board with a sash pinned to it. BHS Band was printed on the sash in glitter. A poster of the performer Madonna was on the wall, and another of Deborah Harry and Blondie. On a shelf above the desk, Starling could see a roll of the bright self-adhesive wallpaper Frederica had used to cover her walls. It was not a great job of papering, but better than her own first effort, Starling thought. In an average home, Frederica's room would have been cheerful. In this bleak house, it was shrill. There was an echo of desperation in it. Frederica did not display photographs of herself in the room. Starling found one in the school yearbook on the small bookcase. Glee Club, Home Ec Club, So-and-So, Band, 4-H Club. Maybe the pigeon served as her 4-H project. Frederica's school annual had some signatures. To a great pal, and a great gal, and my chemistry buddy, and remember the bake sale. Could Frederica bring her friends up here? Did she have a friend good enough to bring up those stairs beneath the drip? There was an umbrella beside the door. Look at this picture of Frederica. Here she's in the front row of the band. Frederica is wide and fat, but her uniform fits better than the others. She's big and she has beautiful skin. Her irregular features combine to make a pleasant face, but she is not attractive looking by conventional standards. Kimberly Emberg wasn't what you would call fetching either, not to the mindless gape of high school, and neither were a couple of the others. Catherine Martin, though, would be attractive to anybody, a big, good-looking young woman who would have to fight the fat when she was 30. Remember, he doesn't look at women as a man looks at them. Conventionally attractive doesn't count. They just have to be smooth and roomy. Starling wondered if he thought of women as skins, the way some cretins call them cunts. She became aware of her own hand, tracing the line of credits beneath the yearbook picture, became aware of her entire body, the space she filled, her figure and her face, their effect, the power in them, her breasts above the book, her hard belly against it, her legs below it. What of her experience applied? Starling saw herself in the full-length mirror on the end wall and was glad to be different from Frederica. But she knew the difference was a matrix in her thinking. What might it keep her from seeing? How did Frederica want to appear? What was she hungry for? Where did she seek it? What did she try to do about herself? Here were a couple of diet plans. The fruit juice diet, the rice diet, and a crackpot plan where you don't eat and drink at the same sitting. Organized diet groups. Did Buffalo Bill watch them to find big girls? Hard to check. Starling knew from the file that two of the victims had belonged to diet groups and that the membership rosters had been compared. An agent from the Kansas City office, the FBI's traditional fat boys bureau, and some overweight police were sent around to work out at Slenderella and Diet Center and join Weight Watchers and other diet denominations in the victims' towns. She didn't know if Catherine Martin belonged to a diet group. Money would have been a problem for Frederica in organized dieting. Frederica had several issues of Big Beautiful Girl, a magazine for large women. Here she was advised to come to New York City, where you can meet newcomers from parts of the world where your size is considered a prized asset. Right. Alternatively, you could travel to Italy or Germany, where you won't be alone after the first day. You bet. Here's what to do if your toes hang out over the ends of your shoes. Jesus. All Frederica needed was to meet Buffalo Bill, who considered her size a prized asset. How did Frederica manage? She had some makeup, a lot of skin stuff. Good for you, use that asset. Starling found herself rooting for Frederica, as though it mattered anymore. She had some junk jewelry in a white owl cigar box. Here was a gold-filled circle pin that most likely had belonged to her late mother. She'd tried to cut the fingers off some old gloves of machine lace to wear them Madonna style, but they'd raveled on her. She had some music, a single-shot Decca record player from the 50s with a jackknife attached to the tone arm with rubber bands for weight. Yard Sale Records. Love themes by Zamfir, master of the pan flute. When she pulled the string to light the closet, Starling was surprised at Frederica's wardrobe. She had nice clothes, not a great many, but plenty for school, enough to get along in a fairly formal office or even a dressy retail job. A quick look inside them, and Starling saw the reason. Frederica made her own, and made them well. The seams were bound with a serger, the facings carefully fitted. Stacks of patterns were on a shelf at the back of the closet. Most of them were simplicity, but there were a couple of vogues that looked hard. She probably wore her best thing to the job interview. What had she worn? Starling flipped through her file. Here, last seen wearing a green outfit. Come on, officer, what the hell is a green outfit? Frederica suffered from the Achilles heel of the budget wardrobe. She was short on shoes, and at her weight she was hard on the shoes she had. Her loafers were strained into ovals. She wore odor eaters in her sandals. The eyelets were stretched in her running shoes. Maybe Frederica exercised a little. She had some outsized warm-ups. They were made by Juno. Catherine Martin also had some fat pants made by Juno. Starling backed out of the closet. She sat on the foot of the bed with her arms folded and stared into the lighted closet. Juno was a common brand, sold in a lot of places that handle outsizes. But it raised the question of clothing. Every town of any size has at least one store specializing in clothes for fat people. Did Buffalo Bill watch fat stores, select a customer and follow her? Did he go into oversized shops in drag and look around? Every oversized shop in a city gets both transvestites and drag queens as customers. The idea of Buffalo Bill trying to cross over sexually had just been applied to the investigation very recently, since Dr. Lecter gave Starling his theory. What about his clothes? All of the victims must have shopped in fat stores. Catherine Martin would wear a 12, but the others couldn't. And Catherine must have shopped in an oversized store to buy the big Juno sweats. Catherine Martin could wear a 12. She was the smallest of the victims. Frederica, the first victim, was largest. How was Buffalo Bill managing to downsize with the choice of Catherine Martin? Catherine was plenty buxom, but she wasn't that big around. Had he lost weight himself? Might he have joined a diet group lately? Kimberly Emberg was sort of in between, big, but with a good waist indention. Starling had specifically avoided thinking about Kimberly Emberg, but now the memory swamped her for a second. Starling saw Kimberly on the slab in Potter. Buffalo Bill hadn't cared about her waxed legs, her carefully glittered fingernails. He looked at Kimberly's flat bosom, and it wasn't good enough, and he took his pistol and blew a starfish in her chest. The door to the room pushed open a few inches. Starling felt the movement in her heart before she knew what it was. A cat came in, a large tortoiseshell cat with one eye gold, the other blue. It hopped up on the bed and rubbed against her, looking for Frederica. Loneliness. Big, lonesome girls trying to satisfy somebody. The police had eliminated Lonely Hearts Clubs early. Did Buffalo Bill have another way to take advantage of loneliness? Nothing makes us more vulnerable than loneliness except greed. Loneliness might have permitted Buffalo Bill an opening with Frederica, but not with Catherine. Catherine wasn't lonesome. Kimberly was lonesome. Don't start this. Kimberly, obedient and limp, past rigor mortis, being rolled over on the mortician's table so Starling could fingerprint her. Stop it. Can't stop it. Kimberly, lonesome, anxious to please. Had Kimberly ever rolled over obediently for someone, just to feel his heart beat against her back? She wondered if Kimberly had felt whiskers grating between her shoulder blades. Staring into the lighted closet, Starling remembered Kimberly's plump back, the triangular patches of skin missing from her shoulders. Staring into the lighted closet, Starling saw the triangles on Kimberly's shoulders outlined in the blue dashes of a dressmaking pattern. The idea swam away and circled and came again, came close enough for her to grab it this time, and she did with a fierce pulse of joy. They're darts! He took those triangles to make darts so he could let out her waist. Motherfucker can sew. Buffalo Bill's trained to seriously sew. He's not just picking out ready to wear. What did Dr. Lecter say? He's making himself a girl suit out of real girls. What did he say to me? Do you sew, Clarice? Damn straight I do. Starling put her head back, closed her eyes for 1 second. Problem-solving is hunting. It is savage pleasure, and we are born to it. She'd seen a telephone in the parlor. She started downstairs to use it, but Mrs. Bimmel's reedy voice was calling up to her already, calling her to the phone. Chapter 53. Mrs. Bimmel gave Starling the telephone and picked up the fretting baby. She didn't leave the parlor. Clarice Starling. Jerry Burroughs, Starling. Good, Jerry. Listen, I think Buffalo Bill can sew. He cut the triangles. Just a sec. Mrs. Bimmel, could I ask you to take the baby in the kitchen? I need to talk here. Thank you. Jerry, he can sew. He took those triangles off of Kimberly Emberg to make darts. Dressmaking darts. Do you know what I'm saying? He's skilled. He's not just making caveman stuff. ID section can search known offenders for tailors, sailmakers, drapers, upholsterers. Run a scan on the distinguishing marks field for a tailor's notch in his teeth. Right. I'm punching up a line now to ID. Now listen up. I may have to get off the phone here. Jack wanted me to brief you. We got a name and a place that looks not bad. The hostage rescue team's airborne from Andrews. Jack's briefing them on the scrambler. Going where? Calumet City, edge of Chicago. Subject's Jane, like name with a J. Last name Gum, a.k.a. John Grant. WM34190, brown and blue. Jack got a beep from Johns Hopkins. Your thing, your profile, and how he'd be different from a transsexual. It rang the cherries at Johns Hopkins. Guy applied for a sex reassignment 3 years ago. Roughed up a doctor after they turned him down. Hopkins had the Grant alias and a flop address in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. The cops had a gas receipt with his tag number, and we went from there. Big Jacket in California as a juvenile. He killed his grandparents when he was 12 and did 6 years in Tulare Psychiatric. The state let him out 16 years ago, and they shut down the asylum. He disappeared a long time. He's a fag basher, had a couple of scrapes in Harrisburg, and faded out again. Chicago, you said. How do you know Chicago? Customs. They had some paper on the John Grant alias. Customs stopped a suitcase at LAX a couple of years ago, shipped from Suriname with live pupae, and how you say it, insects anyway, moths in it. The addressee was John Grant, care of a business in Calumet called, get this, called Mr. Hyde. Leather goods. Maybe the sewing fits with that. I'm relaying the sewing to Chicago and Calumet. No home address yet on Grant or Gum. The business is closed, but we're close. Any pictures? Just the juveniles from Sacramento PD so far. They're not much use. He was 12. Looked like Beaver Cleaver. The wire room's faxing them around anyway. Can I go? No. Jack said you'd ask. They've got two female marshals from Chicago and a nurse to take charge of Martin if they get her. You'd never be in time anyway, Starling. What if he's barricaded? It could take there won't be any standoff. They find him, they fall on him. Crawford's authorized an explosive entry. Special problems with this guy, Starling. He's been in a hostage situation before. His juvenile homicides, they got him in a barricade situation in Sacramento with his grandmother as hostage. He'd already killed his grandef already, but say we're lucky. Say he had a lot on his mind. One thing and another, he didn't get around to it yet. If he sees us coming, he'll do her right in our faces for spite. Cost him nothing, right? So they find him, and boom, the door's down. The room was too damned hot, and it smelled of baby ammonia. Burroughs was still talking. We're looking for both names on the Entomology magazine subscription lists. Knife Makers Guild, Known Offenders, the works. Nobody stands down until it's over. You're doing Bimmel's acquaintances, right?
Right.
Justice says it's a tricky case to make if we don't catch him dirty. We need him with Martin or with something identifiable, something with teeth or fingers, frankly. Goes without saying, if he's dumped Martin already, we need witnesses to put him with a victim before the fact. We can use your stuff from Bimmel regardless. Starling, I wish to God this had happened yesterday for more reasons than the Martin kid. They throw the switch on you at Quantico?
I think so.
They put in somebody else that was waiting out a recycle, that's what they tell me. If we get him in Chicago, you made a lot of contribution here. They're hard asses at Quantico like they're supposed to be, but they have to see that. Wait a minute. Starling could hear Burroughs barking away from the phone, then he was back again. Nothing. They can deploy in Calumet City in 40 to 55, depends on the winds aloft. Chicago SWAT's deputized in case they find him sooner. Calumet Power and Lights come up with four possible addresses. Starling, watch for anything they can use up there to narrow it down. You see anything about Chicago or Calumet, get to me fast.
Righto.
Now, listen. This and I gotta go. If it happens, if we get him in Calumet City, you fall in at Quantico 0800 mañana with your Mary Jane shined. Jack's going before the board with you. So is the Chief Gunny Brigham. It don't hurt to ask.
Jerry, one other thing. Frederica Bimmel had some warm-ups made by Juno. It's a brand of fat clothes. Catherine Martin had some, too, for what it's worth. He might watch fat stores to find large victims. We could ask Memphis, Akron, the other places.
Got it. Keep smiling.
Starling walked out in the junky yard in Belvedere, Ohio, 380 long miles from the action in Chicago. The cold air felt good on her face. She threw a small punch in the air, rooting hard for the hostage rescue team. At the same time, she felt a little trembly in her chin and cheeks. What the hell was this? What the hell would she have done if she'd found anything? She'd have called the cavalry, the Cleveland Field Office, and Columbus SWAT, the Belvedere PD, too. Saving the young woman, saving the daughter of Senator Fuck You Martin and the ones that might come after. Truly, that was what mattered. If they did it, everybody was right. If they weren't in time, if they found something awful, please God, they got Buffett, got Jame Gum, or Mr. Hyde, or whatever they wanted to call the damned thing. Still, to be so close, to get a hand on the rump of it, to have a good idea a day late and wind up far from the arrest, busted out of school, it all smacked of losing. Starling had long suspected, guiltily, that the Starlings' luck had been sour for a couple of 100 years now, that all the Starlings had been wandering around, pissed off and confused, back through the mists of time, that if you could find the tracks of the first Starling, they would lead in a circle. This was classic loser thinking, and she was damned if she'd entertain it. If they caught him because of the profile she'd gotten from Dr. Lecter, it had to help her with the Department of Justice. Starling had to think about that a little. Her career hopes were twitching like a phantom limb. Whatever happened, having the flash on the dressmaking pattern had felt nearly as good as anything ever had. There was stuff to keep here. She'd found courage in the memory of her mother as well as her father. She'd earned and kept Crawford's confidence.
These were things to keep in her own White Owl cigar box. Her job, her duty, was to think about Frederica and how Gum might have gotten her. A criminal prosecution of Buffalo Bill would require all the facts. Think about Frederica, stuck here all her young life. Where would she look for the exit? Did her longings resonate with Buffalo Bill's? Did that draw them together? Awful thought that he might have understood her out of his own experience, empathized even, and still helped himself to her skin. Starling stood at the edge of the water. Almost every place has a moment of the day, an angle, an intensity of light in which it looks its best. When you're stuck someplace, you learn that time and you look forward to it. This mid-afternoon was probably the time for the licking river behind Fell Street. Was this the Bimmel girl's time to dream? The pale sun raised enough vapor off the water to blur the old refrigerators and ranges dumped in the brush on the far side of the backwater. The northeast wind opposite the light pushed the cattails toward the sun. A piece of white PVC pipe led from Mr. Bimmel's shed toward the river. It gurgled, and a brief rush of bloody water came out, staining the old snow. Bimmel came out into the sun. The front of his trousers was flecked with blood, and he carried some pink and gray lumps in a plastic food bag. "Squab," he said when he saw Starling looking. "Ever eat squab?" "No," Starling said, turning back to the water. "I've eaten doves. Never have to worry about biting on a shot in these."
"Mr. Bimmel, did Frederica know anybody from Calumet City or the Chicago area?"
He shrugged and shook his head.
"Had she ever been to Chicago, to your knowledge?"
"What do you mean, to my knowledge? You think a girl of mine's going off to Chicago and I don't know it? She didn't go to Columbus, I didn't know it."
"Did she know any men that sew? Tailors or sailmakers?"
"She sewed for everybody. She could sew like her mother. I don't know of any men. She sewed for stores, for ladies, I don't know who."
"Who was her best friend, Mr. Bimmel? Who did she hang out with?"
"Didn't mean to say hang."
"Good, it didn't stick him. He's just pissed off."
"She didn't hang out like the good-for-nothings. She always had some work. God didn't make her pretty. He made her busy."
"Who would you say was her best friend?"
"Stacy Hubka, I guess, since they were little. Frederica's mother used to say Stacy went around with Frederica just to have somebody to wait on her. I don't know."
"Do you know where I could get in touch with her?"
"Stacy worked at the insurance. I guess she still does. A Franklin Insurance."
Starling walked to her car across the rutted yard, her head down, hands deep in her pockets. Frederica's cat watched her from the high window. Chapter 54. FBI credentials get a snappier response the farther west you go. Starling's ID, which might have raised one bored eyebrow on a Washington functionary, got the undivided attention of Stacy Hubka's boss at the Franklin Insurance Agency in Belvedere, Ohio. He relieved Stacy Hubka at the counter and the telephones himself, and offered Starling the privacy of his cubicle for the interview. Stacy Hubka had a round, downy face, and stood 5'4" in heels. She wore her hair in frosted wings and used a Cher Bono move to brush them back from her face. She looked Starling up and down whenever Starling wasn't facing her.
"Stacy, may I call you Stacy?"
"Sure."
"I'd like you to tell me, Stacy, how you think this might have happened to Frederica Bimmel, where this man might have spotted Frederica."
"Freak me out. Get your skin peeled off. Is that a bummer? Did you see her? They said she was just like rags, like somebody let the air out of Stacy."
"Did she ever mention anybody from Chicago or Calumet City?"
Calumet City. The clock above Stacy Hubka's head worried Starling. If the hostage rescue team makes it in 40 minutes, they're just 10 minutes from touchdown. Did they have a hard address?
"Tend to your business."
"Chicago?" Stacy said. "No. We marched at Chicago one time in a Thanksgiving parade."
"When?"
8th grade. That would be, what, 9 years ago. The band just went there and back on the bus."
"What did you think last spring when she first disappeared?"
"I just didn't know."
Remember where you were when you first found it out, when you got the news? What did you think then?
That first night she was gone, Skip and me went to the show, and then we went to Mr. Toad's for a drink, and Pam and them, Pam Malvisi, came in and said Frederica disappeared, and Skip goes, Houdini could make Frederica disappear. And then he's got to tell everybody who Houdini was. He's always showing off how much he knows. And we just sort of blew it off. I thought she's just mad at her dad. Did you see her house? Is that the pits? I mean, wherever she is, I know she's embarrassed. You saw it. Wouldn't you run away?
Did you think maybe she'd run away with somebody? Did anybody pop into your mind, even if it was wrong?
Skip said maybe she'd found her a chubby chaser, but no, she never had anybody like that. She had one boyfriend, but that's like ancient history. He was in a band in the 10th grade. I say boyfriend, but they just talked and giggled like a couple of girls and did homework. He was a big sissy, though, wore one of these little Greek fisherman's caps. Skip thought he was a queer. She got kidded about going out with a queer. Him and his sister got killed in a car wreck, though, and she never got anybody else.
What did you think when she didn't come back?
Pam thought maybe it was some Moonies got her. I didn't know. I was scared every time I thought about it. I wouldn't anymore go out at night without Skip. I told him, I said, buddy, when the sun goes down, we go out.
Did you ever hear her mention anybody named Jane Gum or John Grant?
No.
Do you think she could have had a friend you didn't know about? Were there gaps in time, days when you didn't see her?
No. She had a guy I'd have known, believe me. She never had a guy.
Do you think it might be just possible, let's say she could have had a friend and didn't say anything about it?
Why wouldn't she?
Scared she'd get kidded, maybe?
Kidded by us? What are you saying, because of the other time, the sissy kid in high school?
Stacy reddened.
No. No way we would hurt her. I just mentioned that together. She didn't... Everybody was, like, kind to her after he died.
Did you work with Frederica Stacy?
Me and her and Pam Malavisi and Geronda Askew all worked down at the Bargain Center summers in high school. Then Pam and me went to Richards to see could we get on. It's real nice clothes, and they hired me. And then Pam says to Frederica, come on, they need another girl, and she came. But Mrs. Burdine, the merchandising manager, she goes, well, Frederica, we need somebody that, you know, people can relate to, that they come in and say, I want to look like her, and you can give them advice how they look in this and stuff. And if you want to get yourself together and lose your weight, I want you to come right back here and see me, she says. But right now, if you want to take over some of our alterations, I'll try you at that. I'll put in a word with Mrs. Lipman. Mrs. Burdine talked in this sweetie voice, but she turned out to be a bitch, really. But I didn't know it right at first.
So Frederica did alterations for Richards, the store where you worked?
It hurt her feelings, but sure. Old Mrs. Lipman did everybody's alterations. She had the business, and she had more than she could do, and Frederica worked for her. She did them for old Mrs. Lipman. Mrs. Lipman sewed for everybody, made dresses. After Mrs. Lipman retired, her kid or whatever didn't want to do it, and Frederica got it all and just kept sewing for everybody. That's all she did. She'd meet me and Pam. We'd go to Pam's house on lunch and watch The Young and the Restless, and she'd bring something and be working in her lap the whole time.
Did Frederica ever work at the store taking measurements? Did she meet customers or the wholesale people?
Sometimes. Not much. I didn't work every day.
Did Mrs. Burdine work every day? Would she know?
Yeah, I guess.
Did Frederica ever mention sewing for a company called Mr. Hyde in Chicago or Calumet City, maybe lining leather goods?
I don't know. Mrs. Lipman might have.
Did you ever see the Mr. Hyde brand? Did Richards ever carry it or one of the boutiques?
No.
Do you know where Mrs. Lipman is? I'd like to talk to her.
She died. She went to Florida to retire, and she died down there, Frederica said. I never did know her. Me and Skip just picked up Frederica over there sometimes when she had a bunch of clothes. You might could talk to her family or something. I'll write it down for you.
This was extremely tedious when what Starling wanted was news from Calumet City. 40 minutes was up. The hostage rescue team ought to be on the ground. She shifted so she didn't have to look at the clock and pressed on.
Stacy, where did Frederica buy clothes? Where did she get those oversized Juno workout clothes, the sweats?
She made just about everything. I expect she got the sweats at Richards, you know, when everybody started wearing them real big, so they came down over tights like that. A lot of places carried them then.
She got a discount at Richards because she sewed for him.
Did she ever shop at an oversized store?
We went in every place to look, you know how you do. We'd go in Personality Plus and she'd look for ideas, you know, flattering patterns for big sizes.
Did anybody ever come up and bug you around an oversized store, or did Frederica ever feel somebody had his eye on her?
Stacy looked at the ceiling for a second and shook her head. Stacy, did transvestites ever come into Richards, or men buying large dresses? Did you ever run into that?
No.
Me and Skip saw some at a bar in Columbus one time.
Was Frederica with you?
Not hardly. We'd gone, like, for the weekend.
Would you write down the oversized places you went with Frederica? Do you think you could remember all of them?
Just here or here in Columbus?
Here and Columbus. And Richards, too. I want to talk to Mrs. Burdeen.
Okay. Is it a pretty good job being an FBI agent?
I think it is.
You get to travel around and stuff. I mean, places better than this.
Sometimes you do.
Got to look good every day, right?
Well, yeah. You have to try to look businesslike.
How do you get into that, being an FBI agent?
You have to go to college first, Stacy.
That's tough to pay for.
Yeah, it is.
Sometimes there are grants and fellowships that help out, though.
Would you like me to send you some stuff?
Yeah. I was just thinking, Frederica was so happy for me when I got this job. She really got her rocks off. She never had a real office job. She thought this was getting somewhere. This, cardboard files and Barry Manilow on the speakers all day. She thought it was hot shit. What did she know, big dummy?
Tears stood in Stacy Hubka's eyes. She opened them wide and held her head back to keep from having to do her eyes over. How about my list now?
I better do it at my desk. I got my word processor and I need my phone book and stuff.
She went out with her head back, navigating by the ceiling.
It was the telephone that was tantalizing Starling. The moment Stacy Hubka was out of the cubicle, Starling called Washington Collect to get the news.
Chapter 55. At that moment, over the southern tip of Lake Michigan, a 24-passenger business jet with civilian markings came off maximum cruise and began the long curve down to Calumet City, Illinois. The 12 men of the hostage rescue team felt the lift in their stomachs. There were a few elaborately casual tension yawns up and down the aisle. Team Commander Joel Randall, at the front of the passenger compartment, took off the headset and glanced over his notes before he got up to talk. He believed he had the best-trained SWAT team in the world, and he may have been right. Several of them had never been shot at, but as far as simulations and tests could tell, these were the best of the best. Randall had spent a lot of time in airplane aisles and kept his balance easily in the bumpy descent. "Gentlemen, our ground transportation's courtesy of DEA undercover. They've got a florist's truck and a plumbing van. So, Vernon, Eddie, into your long handles and your civvies. If we go in behind stun grenades, remember you've got no flash protection on your faces." Vernon muttered to Eddie, "Make sure you cover up your cheeks."
"Did he say don't moon? I thought he said don't flash," Eddie murmured back.
Vernon and Eddie, who would make the initial approach to the door, had to wear thin ballistic armor beneath civilian clothes. The rest could go in hard shell armor, proof against rifle fire.
"Bobby, make sure and put one of those handsets in each van for the driver so we don't get fucked up talking to those DEA guys," Randall said.
"The Drug Enforcement Administration uses UHF radios in raids, while the FBI has VHF. There had been problems in the past." They were equipped for most eventualities, day or night. For walls, they had basic rappelling equipment. To listen, they had wolf's ears and a Van Sleek Farfoon. To see, they had night vision devices. The weapons with night scopes looked like band instruments in their bulging cases. This was to be a precise surgical operation, and the weapons reflected it. There was nothing that fired from an open bolt. The team shrugged into their web gear as the flaps went down. Randall got news from Calumet on his headset. He covered the microphone and spoke to the team again. "Guys, they got it down to two addresses. We take the best one and Chicago SWAT's on the other." The field was Lansing Municipal, the closest to Calumet on the southeast side of Chicago. The plane was cleared straight in.
The pilot brought it to a stop in a stink of brakes beside two vehicles idling at the end of the field farthest from the terminal. There were quick greetings beside the florist's truck. The DEA commander handed Randall what looked like a tall flower arrangement. It was a 12-pound doorbuster sledgehammer, the head wrapped in colored foil like a flower pot, foliage attached to the handle. "You might want to deliver this," he said. "Welcome to Chicago." Chapter 56. Mr. Gum went ahead with it in the late afternoon. With dangerous, steady tears standing in his eyes, he'd watched his video again and again and again. On the small screen, Mom climbed the water slide and wee down into the pool. Tears blurred Jane Gum's vision as though he were in the pool himself. On his middle, a hot water bottle gurgled, as the little dog's stomach had gurgled when she lay on him. He couldn't stand it any longer. What he had in the basement holding Precious prisoner, threatening her. Precious was in pain. He knew she was. He wasn't sure he could kill it before it fatally injured Precious, but he had to try, right now. He took off his clothes and put on the robe. He always finished a harvest naked, and bloody as a newborn. From his vast medicine cabinet he took the salve he had used on Precious when the cat scratched her. He got out some little band-aids and Q-tips and the plastic Elizabethan collar the vet gave him to keep her from worrying a sore place with her teeth. He had tongue depressors in the basement to use for splints on her little broken leg, and a tube of stingies to take the hurt away if the stupid thing scratched her thrashing around before it died. A careful headshot, and he just sacrificed the hair. Precious was worth more to him than the hair. The hair was a sacrifice, an offering for her safety. Quietly down the stairs now, to the kitchen, out of his slippers and down the dark basement stairs, staying close to the wall to keep the stairs from creaking. He didn't turn on the light. At the bottom of the stairs he took a right into the workroom, moving by touch in the familiar dark, feeling the floor change under his feet. His sleeve brushed the cage, and he heard the soft, angry chirp of a brood moth. Here was the cabinet. He found his infrared light and slipped the goggles on his head. Now the world glowed green. He stood for a moment in the comforting burble of the tanks, in the warm hiss of the steam pipes, master of the dark, queen of the dark. Moths free in the air left green trails of fluorescence across his vision, faint breaths across his face as their downy wings brushed the darkness. He checked the python. It was loaded with 38 special lead wad cutters. They would slam into the skull and expand for an instant kill. If it was standing when he shot, if he shot down into the top of the head, the bullet was less likely than a magnum load to exit the lower jaw and tear the bosom. Quiet. Quiet, he crept. Knees bent, painted toes gripping the old boards. Silent on the sand floor of the oubliette room, quiet, but not too slow. He didn't want his scent to have time to reach the little dog in the bottom of the well. The top of the oubliette glowed green, the stones and mortar distinct, the grain of the wooden cover sharp in his vision. Hold the light and lean over. There they were. It was on its side, like a giant shrimp. Perhaps asleep. Precious was curled up close against its body. Surely sleeping. Oh, please, not dead. The head was exposed. A neck shot was tempting. Save the hair. Too risky. Mr. Gum leaned over the hole, the stalk eyes of his goggles peering down. The python has a good, muzzle-heavy feel. Wonderfully pointable it is. Have to hold it in the beam of infrared. He lined up the sights on the side of its head, just where the hair was damp against the temple.
Noise or smell, he never knew, but Precious up and yipping, jumping straight up in the dark, Catherine Baker Martin doubling around the little dog and pulling the futon over them, just lumps moving under the futon. He couldn't tell what was dog and what was Catherine. Looking down in infrared, his depth perception was impaired. He couldn't tell which lumps were Catherine. But he had seen Precious jump. He knew her leg was all right, and at once he knew something more. Catherine Baker Martin wouldn't hurt the dog any more than he would. Oh, sweet relief! Because of their shared feeling, he could shoot her in the goddamned legs, and when she clutched her legs, blow her fucking head off. No caution necessary. He turned on the lights, all the damned lights in the basement, and got the floodlight from the storeroom. He had control of himself. He was reasoning well. On his way through the workroom, he remembered to run a little water in the sinks so nothing would clot in the traps. As he hurried past the stairs, ready to go, carrying the floodlight, the doorbell rang. The doorbell grating, rasping. He had to stop and think about what it was. He hadn't heard it in years. Hadn't even known whether it worked. Mounted in the stairway so it could be heard upstairs and down, clanging now, a black metal tit covered with dust. As he looked at it, it rang again, kept ringing, dust flying off it. Someone was at the front, pushing the old button marked superintendent. They would go away. He rigged the floodlight. They didn't go away. Down in the well, it said something he paid no attention to. The bell was clanging, grating. They were just leaning on the button. Better go upstairs and peek out the front. The long-barreled python wouldn't go in the pocket of his robe. He put it on the workroom counter. He was halfway up the stairs when the bell stopped ringing. He waited a few moments, halfway up. Silence. He decided to look anyway. As he went through the kitchen, a heavy knock on the back door made him jump. In the pantry near the back door was a pump shotgun. He knew it was loaded. With the door closed to the basement stairs, nobody could hear it yelling down there. Even at the top of its voice, he was sure of that. Banging again. He opened the door a crack on the chain. "I tried the front, but nobody came," Clarice Starling said. "I'm looking for Mrs. Lipman's family. Could you help me?" "They don't live here," Mr. Gums said and closed the door. He had started for the stairs again when the banging resumed, louder this time. He opened the door on the chain. The young woman held an ID close to the crack. It said Federal Bureau of Investigation. "Excuse me, but I need to talk to you. I need to find the family of Mrs. Lipman. I know she lived here. I want you to help me, please."
"Mrs. Lipman's been dead for ages. She didn't have any relatives that I know of."
"What about a lawyer or an accountant? Somebody who'd have her business records? Did you know Mrs. Lipman?"
"Just briefly, what's the problem?"
"I'm investigating the death of Frederica Bimmel. Who are you, please?"
"Jack Gordon."
"Did you know Frederica Bimmel when she worked for Mrs. Lipman?"
"No." "Was she a great fat person? I may have seen her, I'm not sure. I didn't mean to be rude, I was sleeping." "Mrs. Lipman had a lawyer, I may have his card somewhere. I'll see if I can find it. Do you mind stepping in? I'm freezing and my cat will streak through here in a second. She'll be outside like a shot before I can catch her."
He went to a roll-top desk in the far corner of the kitchen, raised the top, and looked in a couple of pigeonholes. Starling stepped inside the door and took her notebook out of her purse.
"That horrible business," he said, rummaging the desk. "I shiver every time I think about it. Are they close to catching somebody, do you think?"
"Not yet, but we're working. Mr. Gordon, did you take over this place after Mrs. Lipman died?"
"Yes."
Gum bent over the desk, his back to Starling. He opened a drawer and poked around in it. "Were there any records left here, business records?"
"No, nothing at all. Does the FBI have any ideas? The police here don't seem to know the first thing. Do they have a description or fingerprints?"
Out of the folds in the back of Mr. Gum's robe crawled a death's head moth. It stopped in the center of his back, about where his heart would be, and adjusted its wings. Starling dropped her notebook into the bag. Mr. Gum, thank God my coat's open. Talk out of here, go to a phone. No, he knows I'm FBI. If I let him out of my sight, he'll kill her. Do her kidneys. They find him, they fall on him. His phone. Don't see it. Not in here. Ask for his phone. Get the